Hello and welcome to The Logistics Tribe. I'm Boris Felgandrea, founder of The Logistics Tribe, and today I have a very special episode for you. It's different because we typically bring you conversations between a host and one or sometimes two guests that are 45 minutes or so in length. Today's episode is a deep dive into one very specific topic with two people who have very deep domain expertise in this field. And the episode is 2 hours and 45 minutes long. Yes, that's right. The idea here is to really take the time to tackle one very specific topic and go super deep on it. It's a bit of an experiment that we haven't tried before, and I'm not aware of a lot of podcasts who have done this type of thing in logistics. Today's topic is platforms in logistics, and the two experts are Jonah McIntyre, who's been a regular contributor to the Logistics Tribe, both as a host and a guest, and Merton Vescame, who's currently a product strategist at Transporeon. Both are super deep thinkers on this topic, as you will soon find out. They look at examples of businesses that are platforms versus businesses that aren't, what the defining attributes of platforms are, what areas of logistics and supply chain platforms are suitable for, what successful platforms do differently, how they compete against each other, and much more. And there's a LinkedIn post that Jonah has prepared that will accompany this podcast episode. You will find a link to this post in the show notes. Please visit the post and contribute to the discussion. You can also let us know there how you like the content of this episode. We really appreciate your feedback on this. Before we get started with today's show, a quick thanks to our supporters Grey Orange. Grey Orange automates warehouse operations through a combination of AI software and autonomous mobile robots. Grey Orange systems are in place at some very prominent companies such as IKEA or the Danish household goods and furniture retailer Jysk. If you're looking to get your warehouse and fulfillment operations to the next level with the help of autonomous robots and automation, you should definitely have Grey Orange on your list. Check them out at greyorange.com. All right, and now let's move on to our deep dive show with Jonah McIntyre and Merton Vescame. Enjoy.
All right, let's kick it off, Merton. I believe we're both excited to do this, right?
Sure, of course.
Yeah. Okay, so what we had today was a deep dive on the question of platforms and logistics and the business models that depend on them. How are they different? And is this really suitable or not to logistics and kind of the future trends? In our prep, we had talked about covering what is a platform business as just an opener. So we need to level set, I think, for ourselves and also for everybody else who's listening. What do we mean when we talk about platform businesses? You know, I'll just throw this out here. I see these as strictly multi-party interactions as the core of the value creation and the value capture. If, you know, if you don't bring multi-party interaction in the core of your business, then it's going to be hard for you to call yourself a platform. You agree with that?
Yes, but I think the key there is that the platform itself does not own the interaction or the thing that is being interacted on. So it just facilitates that interaction versus it procures something and then tries to sell it off to somebody else. I think that's also a key differentiator.
Yeah, that's an interesting difference. So if you were to, can you kind of contrast what would be an example of something then that's platform and some other business model, which is not platform, but dealing with essentially the same data or the same interactions, but it's doing it in a, I bought it, so I own it. Now I'm going to hand it off to somebody else sense.
Yeah, I think perhaps Amazon is a good example of a platform and also something that is not a platform. So when Amazon buys stuff in order to sell it on to Amazon customers, then it doesn't act as a platform. But when it lends its platform or its services, its environment, paying services, whatever, to other third-party merchants, then it acts as a platform. Because it gives the merchants the ability to put their stuff online to acquire customers and sell it off.
Yeah. And so in that case, it's platform because rather than controlling the interaction, in your view, it has a platform aspect because it's simply acting as a conduit or a meeting place, a facilitator of multi-party interactions.
Yeah. And, you know, platforms don't have to be online. They can also exist in our physical space. And maybe another analogy would be a shopping mall or like a shopping center is a platform for shops and customers, whereas an individual shop is not a platform necessarily because they buy their own products and then they sell it off. So platforms business is to attract multiple parties to one location, either virtual or in real world. Whereas other shops buy stuff in order to sell them. So they have a different business model.
So when I was preparing for this, I was thinking through one of the, I'm very focused on data and kind of technology businesses. One of the key differentiators that I believe enables platforms to become so much more prevalent in digital enterprises or enterprises which the main interactions are around data is the ability for data to be multiplied, that it isn't simply owned, and if I lose one point of data, you gain one point of data. We can both gain one point of data. And when I think about the physical examples that you're talking about, for example, Amazon's reseller marketplace as a means to have a platform, or a shopping mall as a platform, one of the interesting corollaries is that these are places where it isn't a zero-sum game where, I have take the shopping mall example, the fact that my store at position A in the shopping mall has foot traffic is sort of additive to the other foot traffic around it. It's not like once I have the foot traffic, it's lost to somebody else. And I would imagine if we were to try to dig into platform businesses, they probably at their core, they have something about them which has this additive aspect that in other contexts called network effects, where sort of one addition is beneficial to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. So like the more customers a shopping mall attracts, the more valuable it becomes to the shops, you mean?
Yeah, the more, the more input on some dimension, the more value, not just to the direct interaction, but to sort of to all members or to most members or at least many members. So some sort of multiplying effect, which is inherent in platforms. In the software space and the technology space, we see this just being baked further and further into the unit economics of software, where like in the old days, you would build software which was shipped on disks to be installed on servers. And, if you made a patch or something, you made something else in a future version, it was very difficult to sort of redeploy that and have have any leverage on that investment. And then over time, as we've moved towards SaaS and the idea of having a single code base, which is shared across all customers, and then eventually to a single database, maybe that's shared across all members, you really get this incredible leverage on shared data. And, if you sort of play that back, you would go, well, a CRM, like a customer relationship management tool that was on-premise installed off of a CD onto your server or whatever, it's just very difficult to call that a platform. I don't think anybody can see the platform effect, but something like Salesforce or Force.com or LinkedIn, which might trade in much the same data, kind of in the internal, it's the companies, it's contacts, and so forth. It really does pass the kind of the test of being a platform, because if we look at LinkedIn, you can see this richness of, hey, we're sharing this resource. Nobody but Jonah owns Jonah's profile, but a lot of people use it and they get the benefits of it in this way that multiplies the input.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are also multiple layers to that. So a platform can define a space or a domain on which the participants interact. So Windows or OS is a platform. And it doesn't necessarily define what developers are going to be developing, not even the language that they can use, but it just defines a rough edges of what this platform is about, whereas other platforms are much more strict.
Yeah. One of the when I think about platforms in that sense, like the the rise of Microsoft operating systems, the thing that my mind goes to is standardization. That its primary benefit as a platform is that it's established a kind of a standard for multiple parties to work on to everyone's benefit. And I find the whole standardization direction for platform businesses is super fascinating for me because, you know, kind of by definition, in order to standardize something, you have to diminish something. You when you standardize onto the Microsoft operating system, there's some capability that just isn't possible anymore because you adhere to the standard. So to the extent that platform businesses succeed in their standardization, there's just a very clear value creation trade-off that's happening that says we as the multi-party community who works on this platform are going to agree to not explore some combination of things which are outside the standards, but it's more valuable for us to agree on that in advance and be interoperable than it is for us to have it be Wild West. And then I imagine that's kind of how platforms eventually then get overwhelmed by some new platform, is that space of what you agreed not to explore turns out to have a lot of value in it. And eventually someone sort of recreates a platform which changes the standardization.
Yeah, I think the mobile OS development 15 years ago was a very exciting case study where Android and iOS took over the, what was it called, the Nougias platform, which was more of like a collaborative effort. And then iOS came and kind of unified a lot of things, which was really attractive for developers and users alike. And still, iOS has a very different approach than, let's say, Android. iOS is much more closed, whereas Android is much more open.
Right. And in both cases, you can almost imagine them on a, well, it's multidimensional, but you can imagine them on a continuum where just on something like what does it take, or how deep can you access the physical hardware of the device, you've got, say, a different like point of standardization between iOS and Android as two platform businesses. And in some sense, you see them playing, you see a competition playing out between the two platforms on this question of which one has the right level of standardization. And to kind of go back to like, well, why wouldn't you just blow it all open? It's like, well, you blow it all open, and then what you leave then is, like in this operating system example, is that everybody's mobile phone is sort of exposing anything that could possibly be done at the hardware level and above to all software that you might install. And that's like, let's say it's risky for everybody, but for the minority of people who could handle the risk, it's also very time consuming. And so you can just, it's so obvious that the platform adds value by locking out certain possibilities and calling the rest the standards.
Yeah. Essentially, they bring order to the chaos.
Mm.
And this is attractive. It's predictable. It's convenient. You can develop on it. You can depend on it. That's what platforms... They essentially reduce friction for these interactions.
Yeah.
That's the key value, I think.
Yeah, and I love the idea. Like, it's such a great framing of, like, they are bringers of order to something that would otherwise be chaotic. If you go back to the physical examples that you gave, for example, the shopping mall example, yeah, it completely clicks in. I want to be in a shopping, if I'm a retailer or I'm a consumer, I would like all the stores in the shopping mall to adhere to certain hours, right? I don't want to go to the shopping mall and have 25% of the stores closed because they run their own schedule and, right? So not very value adding. Now, obviously, for any schedule that you would adhere to, it's going to be suboptimal for somebody. So it might be some consumers, the shop's not open, or it might be the stores are saying, well, hey, I don't really want to be open at this time. I don't do a lot of traffic, and I don't want to staff right for this time of day. But I'm going to stay open. In fact, when I was at back at the beginning of my career, when I was at Build-A-Bear Workshop, a retailer, you had a bit this challenge of they were catering towards children, and children's shopping hours are just fundamentally different than, say, the Victoria's Secrets, which would be in the same shopping mall. So you had this thing, but it was in everybody's interest to standardize on the working hours.
Mm-hmm. And I think the shopping mall example also speaks to the reuse of the infrastructure point that you made earlier. So the shops in the shopping malls or the merchants, they get to use the same infrastructure built by the shopping mall developer, the same loading docks, the same heating system, all these utilities.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is essentially scale economy.
Right. So if we try to sort of wrap it up for people who are thinking, all right, very theoretical, what are we coming to as platform businesses, Merton and Jonah? We're essentially saying they've got act as a standardizer, so they bring order to the chaos of some potential interaction. They've got to have multi-party interaction. We're sort of no single player mode platform, right? And they provide some sort of a scale economy on a shared resource. They could be as simple as everybody's chipping in to pay for some infrastructure, operating leverage, essentially, that the parking lot costs a certain amount of money, and if we all chip in to maintain it, it's cheaper than if we get our own parking lots. Or it could be the very Web 2.0 to Web 3.0 phase where it's data. So it's sort of standardization, shared resources, and multi-party interactions. That's platform. Am I doing it right? Am I doing am I summarizing it correctly?
I think that sums it up pretty much. I mean, if we get something else or arrive at something else, we can update the definition.
Okay, so it brings order to chaos. There's multiple parties interacting on it, and they're leveraging shared resources. So does logistics lend itself to that? You know, are businesses that are built on those three fundamentals as a platform business, are they going to be well suited to logistics? What do you think?
I think there are areas where it's true. Logistics is a great place for platform businesses. And then there are areas where it might not be true, at least not all the time. There could be cases where companies are not interested in sharing the infrastructure because infrastructure can also be a competitive advantage. And I think logistics, especially when it comes to data, that's an important aspect to think about.
You know, the first thing that goes through my mind when I ask myself, is logistics inherently good for platform plays, platform businesses, is I go back to my university days and say, well, it's really more supply chain. You know, supply chain management has that three pillars of the flows of material, the flows of capital, and the flows of information across a group of collaborators who are in a value chain. And when I think about those, I go, well, material, which is the logistics arm of that, do they need to have standards set and shared resources, kind of shared investment, and have multi-party interactions? They do, but I suspect that it's the coordination of the whole supply chain. So in other words, the capital and the flow of information, which is actually more appropriate for a platform. Like I think that the technology advances in logistics probably are more centered on the flow of material. So that's things like driverless vehicles, drone deliveries, material handling unit optimization. So I think that it's actually a little far afield to say logistics is going to be ideal for platform plays. So I'm a little contrarian on this, but maybe it's also too much of a technicality. You're probably thinking, yeah, right, just call it logistics and move on.
No, not necessarily. I mean, the way I interpret what you're saying is that the supply chain is the sort of next step from logistics. So you can have coordination of movement of financial flows also in logistics. In a lot of ways, forwarders offer that service. They offer that logistics coordination for smaller asset-owning carriers. They try to package multiple deliveries into one attractive and also financially attractive package for carriers, which is essentially a platform endeavor. But you can also, you know, expand it to the whole supply chain, I think.
I find that last comment interesting because when I think about forwarders, and actually I think about platforms in general, one does wonder, okay, platforms act as almost a mini market. You know, in some sense, they look like a large scale market for goods and services, but just super focused on some subset with instead of an invisible hand establishing things like norms, roles and responsibilities, standards, a very visible hand in the form of the platform owner. And if we do double click on logistics, we think about the large logistics providers, so XPO Logistics, DB Schenker, DHL, these C.H. Robinson, these companies ostensibly provide a service that's sort of what you get at the frontier. So when you kind of ride up on your horse to the edge of these companies, you don't get to buy platform from them. You get to buy like transport execution or a booking service for ocean shipping. But on the inside, the coordination that happens on the inside can look very platform-esque. You know, there can be multi-parties that are being coordinated with standards set to the betterment of everybody and some sort of a shared investment in resources. I think one of the reasons, for example, in the U.S. why the brokerage market remains intact is because in some sense you could think about it as the very large pool of carriers agreeing to pay for a platform called a company like J.B. Hunt, agreeing to pay for that platform so that it will provide them with standardized sort of concentrated invoicing and payment processing. So it is, I guess what I'm saying here is I see your point that forwarders on the inside can look quite platform-esque. It's just that you can't buy a platform from them, right? Like you have to buy the service that they offer, not which is transport or warehousing or something. You can't buy the platform.
I think they are a special kind of platform. Some call them aggregators. Some say aggregators are not a platform at all. I think Bill Gates had this quote that when the interactions that happen on a platform, when the value of those interactions does not exceed the platform's value itself, so when platform is more valuable than the interaction or sum of interactions, then it's not really a platform. And that was directed to Facebook. So Facebook is more valuable than all the interactions combined on Facebook, kind of. Mm-hmm. Facebook tends to commoditize one or many parts of the platform. And I think with forwarders, it's kind of the same. For those who want to ship their cargo, forwarders aggregate the carriers. Mm-hmm. They say that we provide infinite capacity. But still, on the other hand, they connect these two parties, and all parties are aware that the forwarder doesn't own these assets. The forwarder aggregates some sort of capacity.
Yeah. I'm processing it because it is an interesting perspective on the forwarding business. Where's the sort of shared resource, and standardization there? Well, the standardization is clear. Actually, the standardization is clear. The standardization is definitely there. If I am working with XPO Logistics and I want to make a booking with them, like I don't have to alter that format in any way for any of their underlying carriers, right? So I make this sort of standardized, in quotes, standardized booking with XPO, which is maybe defined by XPO, maybe not, but whatever it is, it's single format. And then by working through XPO, I can access sort of a lot of potential counterparties, multiple other parties through that standardization. But where's the shared resource part that maybe I'm not seeing with the forwarders as platforms?
I'm inclined to think that the data is the shared resource there. And I'm thinking about examples such as Uber Freight or Convoy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, would you say that Uber, the taxi business, is that a platform?
Well, there's another one that's kind of challenging is from on the inside, if you were orchestrating it on the inside, if you were a manager of the Uber platform, and I think this applies to Uber Freight as well, it would sure look like a platform. It would sure look like you are bringing in multiple parties, they agree to certain standards, and there's a kind of a shared economy. There's a sharedness or a economy of scale on aspects like the development resources necessary to, you know, to build that technology. But the, you know, the counter argument would be that it's just a service provider. If I'm a rider, what I get is I buy a ride at an arm's length agreed price, and if I'm a driver, in most countries I accept a independent contract job of one job, of one size at a set price. So it's, you know, maybe our vocabulary is not rich enough to encompass all the permutations of platform. What would you say to the Uber or Uber Freight example?
Yeah, I guess there has to be a clear distinction between what is just a network product or product that has network effects versus a platform.
Yes.
And is aggregator in the end a platform or not? I think that's also an open discussion still.
Yeah, I think when we touch on this, like, what is the difference between a network effects product and a platform? Because there are network effects aspects to things like just a catalog, you know, that if we agree, if somebody puts together a catalog, there's some element of one edition sort of helps everybody else. But is that a platform? You know, I'm not so sure.
Would you say a newspaper is a platform?
Yes.
Or a magazine?
Maybe it's a bias.
I would say that with magazines, it's clear because those who read magazines, they get stories, sometimes with a discount. And usually those stories are focused around one theme, either beauty or hobbies. And the magazines make most of the money through advertisements.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, Facebook and other social media, well, they sort of debundled that or they got into that value chain and aggregated all the eyes on their platforms.
Yeah. I wonder, as we go through this conversation, it's kind of bubbling up in the back of my mind that perhaps I have a bias against old school businesses like a magazine that makes me say, yeah, it just can't be a platform because it's just too old. It's just too old school. And that's unfortunate that my bias is that, because clearly you can have platform businesses that predate kind of the modern internet. But I just so associate it with businesses that are asset light, that their primary product is the matching and the matchmaking between parties. And that's certainly a group of people who are platforms, but it's not exhaustive.
I think the bias might come from, so tell me if I'm correct, that you are assuming that on a platform, all the parties want to be connected or get connected with somebody else. Whereas in ad business, it's not often that you want to see those ads, but you're willing to go through the ads because of some value you get from the platform. So it's not always voluntary, the matchmaking.
Yes, Yes, I think that's true. So I come into it with a naive and unstated assumption that a platform business will make its platform nature clear to the participants, and they'll know that they're essentially joining, signing up, entering a platform. Now, they may not be fully aware of the economic conditions for all the other parties. I think the example you give is a great one. Old school economy, magazines make most of their, well, they essentially make their money off of the advertisement, not from the subscription fees. If we think about the beautiful triangle that sits behind a business like YouTube, where you've got viewers or consumers like you and me, we want to go see stuff that's produced by group two, which is the content creators. The content creators, maybe they care about us, maybe they don't, but what they really want to be do is they want to be paid by advertisers. So that's group three. And the advertisers don't care at all about the content. All they care about is inserting 10 seconds of advertisements for every 200 seconds of video watching in front of consumers like you and me. And so you've got three parties, each really seeking the input or the resource or whatever of one other one. And it's hugely profitable. It's not just profitable, it's also value creating. Like everybody in that triangle wins. But the thing, to come back to the magazine example, the thing that is interesting to me is that I see that as everyone knows what they're getting into. Whereas with the magazines, I sort of suspect that most magazine readers, they don't quite know that that triangle exists. They think that they're buying the mag, they're paying for the magazine. They think they're the ones that are supporting the authors, when in fact they're not, right?
Yeah, I could imagine, or maybe you remember or have read some local newspapers. You try to imagine the days before the internet, and this was...
I love that you say you can remember. You know, they barely exist anymore. yeah, that's true.
If you remember the days before the internet,
right?
Then this was one of the very few places where a local business could reach out to a wider audience.
Yes.
Outside their neighborhoods.
Well, they also formed another thing, which is, I think, somehow in the constellation of these topics of platform, there's another thing that is sitting around here, which is natural monopolies. If I remember correctly, I believe that this is why Warren Buffett was really into newspapers. I think there was some ego in that. I mean, you get to be... There's a little bit of ego in being on the board of a major newspaper like Washington Post, or being the owner of, you know, the local newspaper. But for most areas, they don't have enough population. This is before internet days. They didn't have enough population to support a lot of newspaper competition. So they formed essentially natural monopolies. And I have a feeling that natural monopoly does sit in this constellation of concepts around platforms, because if you look at the really powerful platforms, they sure do look like, at least for a time period, if they get their standards and their resource, you know, resource sharing right, they sure do look like a monopoly for the space that they sit in.
Yeah. Newspapers were great businesses for a number of reasons. One was also that you had to buy a new one every day. You couldn't like reuse the old one multiple times.
Yeah. Service like product qualities. So you can't sort of buy 10 of them today and save them for tomorrow, and you can't use yesterday's for today. Yeah.
But there's definitely this scale economy effect, especially when it comes to distribution, those things as well.
Yeah. So if we go back to kind of, is logistics inherently lending itself to platform plays, besides the nitpicking on the word logistics compared to supply chain, you know, my view is it probably does. Like, if I just think about them, like, one of the things, if we're going to try to talk about standardization, it's an industry that just begs to be standardized. It just, you know, anybody who spent their career in any way in logistics will lament the fact that there is not enough standardization. And it's ironic because these are not like totally novel processes or data objects that are being standardized. Things like customs clearance, things like purchase orders, stock transfer orders, you know, shipments, bills of lading. These things are just, in some cases, they're legally defined documents. In other cases, they're just very mature, quite stable business objects. And the fact that there isn't standardization here, kind of ubiquitous standardization, is really surprising. But I think that that's, since that's a value of platforms, I think it makes sense. Another thing is that logistics and supply chain is usually occurring across a kind of a depth of companies. You know, maybe there might be five or six companies deep in a value chain. So you got a lot of things to share, a lot of connections to make. And given the platform's abilities to sort of facilitate, again, a economy of scale of investing in connectivity or sharing data, it seems like a natural fit for that as well. So my short answer would be yes. I think that logistics does lend itself to platform as a business model. What do you think?
I would say yes. I would say definitely yes if you agree that the forwarders are platforms. So then you start to see those sort of business models everywhere.
Yeah.
I think it becomes tricky when we talk about platforms that try to connect different forwarders, carriers, those sort of things, and try to standardize their processes. Because I think there's an inherent risk for a lot of companies, because they risk losing what makes them different from others. Those sort of platforms might create indifferentiated experiences for the end users, and that's a risk for these businesses to be commoditized.
Right.
I think that's one of the barriers why we haven't seen sort of winner-takes-all, winner-takes-most type of platforms in logistics. Like, I mean, to the scale that Facebook did with social media or Google did with search, why we don't have this one.
You know, if we keep in examples that are a combination of physical and informational flows, I have always felt like there's lessons to be learned in this regard from the financial industry, in particular things like commodity and or even equity exchanges, where commodity exchanges, future exchanges, for example. You know, you're talking about it's as physical as it gets, right? We're talking about tons, or in some cases less than ton, but you know, mostly like large scale movements of physical goods through pipelines, through bulk shipping. And at the same time as you have that, you have this intense push to standardize, agree on standards, and to bring a combination of like standards and transparency and sort of centrality to it in a way that that brings order to chaos, to kind of use your expression in the beginning. So, you know, I look at a world like, what would the world look like if there wasn't commodity exchanges and there was just over-the-counter exchange, what's called over-the-counter exchanges for big-time commodities like natural gas and oil and wheat and so forth. And you go, well, it'd be a lot worse, right? Like, would just be a lot worse. And then I look at logistics and go, well, there is no, there's no exchange for that. You know, exchange kind of have multiple parties, right? Multi parts to them that make them valuable. They've got standard setting, which that's then enables public trading, and they've got kind of clearing operations that say, we'll take this thing that the parties agreed on, and then we'll clear it in a way that means that neither party really has to establish a direct financial relationship with the other one, they're going through some sort of a central player. That's more common in like equity markets.
Public utility.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And there's also like MasterCard and Visa, very common examples. Indeed. Do you have an answer to that? Did you figure it out?
I think actually logistics is following the path. So there's a if you go back and look at the history of the equity markets, and in particular, if you look at the history of the equity markets as regards to price discovery, which is one of the main elements of, you know, marketplaces or markets, is that they execute kind of two things. They do counterparty discovery, which is, you know, I, Jonah, want to buy some IBM stock, so who do I buy it from? Well, I need to find a counterparty or the best counterparty. And then the second is at what price should that agreement be struck? And that's price discovery. If you go back not too long ago, so the 70s, and you start look at and you inspect, well, how did those two things happen? So in the 70s, for major businesses in the most advanced economies, so in that case in the US for their equities market, listed companies, they would have a couple market makers, and people would find the market maker by looking in a thing called the pink sheet, which is basically a newspaper, right, or a little magazine that went out, and they'd go down through it and they'd be like, I want to buy IBM stock. And you'd see there's four market makers, and maybe one of them is, you know, Meriton's brokerage. And I would call Meriton's brokerage and say, hey, how much is IBM stock? And you'd be required to provide me a buy and a sell rate, but they could be anything. And at the time, you know, that meant that the price for a stock was just insanely different depending on who you knew, because if they felt like they don't know who you are, so if they thought you were maybe somebody just sniffing around for their pricing, they might give you really, really outrageous pricing. So you're going, well, didn't people know about it from the, you know, the public data? Well, there was no public data. I mean, it really took, this is like the formation of the NASDAQ, but it really took decades, actually. You know, it began with delayed end of day reporting, where brokers would report just maybe their average at the end of the day. And then it became the end of day buy and sell. And then and then all the way up till now, you have like this public order book, essentially, which includes volume. So not just I will buy or sell this, but I will buy or sell this, and this is how many shares I would take at that price. I think that logistics would follow a similar path. It's just decades behind. It was a long way to say, yes, I think it's going to happen. I just think it's decades behind. Sorry.
Yeah, I was thinking about the examples that you brought, and I think the key there is scalability, because those businesses would really benefit from this infrastructure because they can scale. And, you know, same thing with MasterCard and Visa as well, especially when travel started to become more common, when the internet was taking off. These businesses had the opportunity to scale, whereas in logistics, the scalability is limited. You can only drive as much with the assets that you have.
Yeah, it's actually a fair point. I mean, as I understand it, obviously I wasn't trading stocks in the 1970s, but as I understand it, those changes were fought really hard by the brokerages kind of at every step. And only a few of the brokerage leaders, or just kind of enough of the brokerage leaders, combined with the public companies that were being, you know, whose stock was being traded, enough people sort of wanted each next step to happen that they were able to push it through. But what we find if we play the tape in reverse and we go, so who was right, who was wrong in that, you know, did brokerage just lose or did brokerage? Well, it turns out they won because they made it up on volume. I mean, but, you know, no question that trading maybe it had a real heyday in the 80s and 90s, but it's made it up on volume. And if I look at logistics, that may be the Achilles heel here. Is I'm not convinced that better price discovery would mean that there would be 10 times as much logistics happening, because which is kind of what happened with trading. Something that used to be quite murky and only the truly experienced people would even consider doing it, and the transaction fees were outrageous. So you didn't really trade; you just bought, and then when you needed to buy a house or something, you sold. Became a more high frequent thing, but I don't think that'll happen with logistics. So maybe that is the barrier to make the motivation for people to shift.
Yeah,
I'm not going to buy and sell. I'm not going to buy and sell as a day logistics. Yeah. Exactly. That's not in the cards.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. The next question, which I think is the one that you and I are just so much, more interested in, because the first two is what's a platform business and does it lend itself to logistics? Those are just us kind of getting our feet on the ground and running. But the next one, which is where we really probably have a lot to talk about, is how do you measure platform businesses different from non-platform businesses? When we were coming into this, the first thing that came to my mind is you measure business like the way you measure business. I mean, it's based on its future potential for free cash flows, sort of discounted back to today. It's just, doesn't matter what industry you're in, doesn't matter what business model you run, things that work find their way to the financials. But I think we both have a view of why that's insufficient. And mine was just, well, if you're building a platform business like you and I are in our day jobs, or if you're examining somebody else's, or you're competing with somebody else's, or if you're an investor thinking about backing one, you need leading metrics. Essentially, you need a mechanism to assess the health, or in our case, to tweak the health of a platform towards being a good business. And that data is not available. The final result on future cash flow, future free cash flow, is not available today.
Mm-hmm. So the question is, what should people interested in platforms look for?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. What are the, from the outside of the castle walls of a platform, and assuming that you can't see its future and you can't get inside and look at the books.
Yeah.
On the outside, what's actually accessible? And then I guess if you're building one also, what should you be considering? So what are the elements that you would look at that aren't just like a normal business? Because normal business, you'd go, well, what's the total addressable market, right? Like, who's the competitors? Those are basics for business, but what's different for platform?
So I think it comes back to the definition that we talked about before, which is that the platform is something that facilitates interactions. So the interactions are key. It's not the total count of users that you have, but rather how many interactions these users create versus how many interactions those users want to have, but were not able to have because of reasons.
Mm.
So overall, I think the term for that is network health. You have a network on your platform and you want that network to be healthy, to be very dense, in a sense that if you're looking to get something out of the platform, then you always get it. So if I use Uber to get a taxi, I usually get a taxi from Uber, and that's great for me. So I think that's a key metric for assessing platforms.
So it's a sort of match success rate. But how would that... But whatever, I mean, I call it match. You're right. It's more like transaction or interaction, because sometimes these interactions are not of the nature of the platform puts you together, but it's that you found each other, or it might be multi-sided. So you have two or three connections necessary in order to make one transaction, something like that. But so, but how would that be different? The success rate to have a interaction on the platform, how would that be different from, say, the drop-off rate on Amazon's web cart? Amazon wants you to complete your purchase as a consumer. They monitor very carefully the drop-off rate. How is that not equivalent to network health in the definition you just gave?
I think in the network case, it's more dynamic. So if I have a bad experience and leave the platform because of that. The other other side on the platform also will have a worse experience because of it.
It's a reverse network. It's network effects on negative with negative.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. I think if you remember, Google had Google Circles. At the time when Facebook was just created, and they had like, they launched, and then they had, I don't know, like 70 million users.
Yeah, and then they didn't.
They just activated for everybody. But the networks were super, super sparse. So I think the average time a user spent on Google Circles was, I don't know, like a couple of minutes per day, maybe. Whereas on Facebook, it was tons higher. Because they had just so much more to do on the platform, so much more people to interact with.
The network, I'm buying the idea of a network health. I'm also buying the idea that it differs from some version of success, say, you know, sales success or transaction success, in that failure has a propagation element to it, that a failure now impacts the, or reduces the likelihood of success in subsequent interactions, not just with that individual customer, but with others. One of the things that's been running through my mind when I try to assess platforms is I do wonder about the trade-off between frequency of interaction and criticality of interaction. So for example, do you have a better platform if your platform is focused on large, kind of large impact, like let's say buying a house, or in the case of logistics, let's say an annual RFQ in procurement. So it happens once a year, right? Large impact, highly critical, but it's infrequent. Now, how does that compare to something like order execution, in transit visibility, these sort of things that are each individual transaction, each individual interaction that the platform might facilitate is of modest value, but there's just so many of them. So kind of in my mind, I'm trying to figure out which, is it both dimensions matter, but of course, then what's the trade-off between these two? Because you're not gonna have high volume of high criticality transactions for most platforms.
Is it kind of like market size in the end? So if you have high volume transactions,
you just multiply it.
It's just a bigger market.
Yeah, you're basically saying just multiply them, and the bigger one is the better one.
Well, I mean, in terms of if you have constrained resources and you need to pick one, then it seems more attractive.
But if you were
you're looking for a niche, some underserved product, then you might have more success looking at the low volume one.
But if you're on the outside of a platform, like let's say you're on the outside of a platform and you were looking at two platforms. Let's say we're looking at local courier delivery, and there's one platform which is matching up buyers and sellers of this service. But they do it on a annual basis. So they're facilitating, you know, they provide standards, they do benchmarking of the data, something like that. And they're matching up buyers and sellers on a frequency of once a year. And then you have another one, let's say the same total spend going through it, but it's doing this on ad hoc shipping. So it's sort of the average interaction, the average parties are coming in and interacting, let's say once per month. So it's a factor of 12. It's basically an order of magnitude difference. Same total value. Which of these do you think, in your opinion, which of these is, or is it irrelevant between these two? Would you look at this and go equally good, off to a good start in their platform business?
So I'm thinking, can I make a case for the first example?
It's higher trust. I mean, the first example would say the bigger the criticality of the interaction, the better branding power, essentially, some form of branding power trust that mm-hmm. the platform is engendering. So I'll put my foot in the water and try something if it's easily reversible or low impact if it fails. If failure means that I lost a bunch of money for a whole year, then you got to be a bit more proven. So I think the platform, the upside to platform A is that to succeed, when you succeed in that business, you've established some form of brand power. In the upside, I guess, in platform B is that, well, one is, you know, the inverse is true. It's easier to get new customers, but the more important thing is the upside for number two is that you are establishing probably more kind of mind share or more of a sticky relationship, one would assume, with the members, because you're just, you know, the way human beings work is they you know, frequency matters, right? If I see somebody daily, I have a stronger relationship with them, even if I add up the number of minutes and I compare it to somebody I see once a month, but for a longer block of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And if I'm working on something where I have to use a specific tool once a year, and I've used it once before, I don't necessarily want to use or learn something new just for that one-time use. Yeah.
Yeah.
If the experience wasn't like super great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair point. That there's a different... The barrier is essentially different. I mean, we'll get into this later when we talk about competition potentials, but the barriers are different. Yeah. One of the things that I find, so as compared to a typical business that wasn't platform, that was just, hey, we buy and sell a service, or we buy and sell a product. One of the things I find different about platforms that I really do try to inspect when someone mentions a platform in our industry is the exact nature of the network effect. So one of the things that that matters with these network effects is kind of, you have to go deeper than the, well, when a new buyer comes in, it's sort of better for all sellers, and when a new seller comes in, it's better for all buyers, or when a new, in the case of data sources, so a new Internet of Things, you know, connection comes onto your real-time visibility platform, it's sort of better for everybody. It's like, well, you really got to inspect that, because some of these network effects, they just never stop, right? Like they essentially, they're additive. Everyone that comes on, or every new interaction, the value that it adds is sort of a pure number X. And maybe the number X diminishes over time, but it's always plus, right? And then others are more like a swapping effect. So if I think about procurement platforms, just as an example, when from a buyer's perspective, if I was a buyer at, let's say, Nike, and I was buying warehousing, when a new warehousing provider comes onto my procurement platform that I'm on, yes, it's more valuable for me, but how was that value actually created? Well, the network effect is that maybe that new seller of warehousing services replaced, or competes with, but basically could replace another one. So that can only go on so long. And it's sort of like somebody loses for somebody else to gain. That's the network effect. Whereas when I think about the benchmarking platform, so think about like Zenata as an example, which is interesting because it's one-sided. There are many multi-party interactions there, but they're all on the same side. They're all buyers. And they submit their data for it to be benchmarked. And nobody loses. So there's no trade-off there. It's simply a linear value add. Now, the value tapers off because kind of what are you going to learn from the million and one contribution? Well, it's going to be a lot smaller than the second contribution, but it is additive. So that's something I pay a lot of attention to. That's something I pay a lot of attention to with platforms.
Yeah. I guess you could also say that at some point, the added value starts to diminish also because of additional spam or the additional cost of having to go through all these interactions that really don't bring you much more new value. Yeah. So then platforms have to start thinking about spam filters or start to restrict interactions. make sure that only the useful ones gets through.
That's also a factor that I think you have to look for in platforms that you don't see in other businesses, which is that you have to balance abundance with relevance. I think that good platform businesses, if you it just think about kind of something like LinkedIn, which we're all familiar with, good platform businesses, as they create an abundance of possible interactions, if left to their own, so if I really wanted to have interactions with 10 people in my network and my network's 100 people, I got a 1 in 10 chance, right? And if I explode that network by 100, kind of factor 100, there may be some in there that I want to have more interactions with. So maybe my interactions now is like a little higher, but it just bloats out with the, you know, the divisor of that ratio, kind of the denominator is just gets too big. And so what I see good platforms doing, and is also a sign, even if you're on the outside and you're sort of, are they really growing? You know, where are they really at? You start noticing that they pay more attention to maintaining high relevance for the parties to combat that sort of abundance of possible interactions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's difficult from the outside to measure those things, though. It's not usually something that gets reported.
Yeah.
What was our match rates?
The only time it's reported is when it's a vanity metric, right?
Yeah. I mean, Elon Musk was supposed to buy Twitter, but it's now stuck because they're fighting over how many bots there are on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know if everybody has that opinion, but it seems to me at least that there certainly should be more than 5% of bots, at least in the network that I follow personally.
Right. Yeah. I think that network owners, they inherently don't have much incentive to sort of be exposed on these. Also, probably if we're honest, I mean, also probably for good reason. I suspect that any platform, kind of by definition, like platform doesn't play the game; it sets the rules of the game, and then the people who are on the platform play. So, the more you reveal about how the inner workings of those rules operate, the more you're inviting yourself to be, you know, if you want to be nice about this, call this growth hacking, but really it's more like spam creation. I mean, I'll tell you like an example from my own experience was when I was starting my first company, there was a platform for, at the time called Investira, now called Verve in Switzerland for angel investors. And as I, you know, as I checked kind of how do you get the attention of angel investors, they were pretty transparent at the time about what are their ranking algorithm and how does one get into the top of the list for the kind of weekly roundup or whatever. And because they were clear about the mechanism of how their platform worked, because their platform was, you know, startups could apply, fill out a profile, provide some details, and then seed investors could see those profiles, but you know there are a lot of profiles. So how do you get to the top of the list? Well, they're pretty clear about that, and therefore it was hackable. And I got us to the top of the list with pretty minimal effort. Now, was that value creating for the platform? You know, maybe if you design the mechanisms properly, then maybe revealing the mechanism is simply like reinforcing good behavior, sort of truthful behavior, makes it easier for people to, you know, Google has done and then not done this in the past with ranking algorithms, where sometimes they would talk about what gets you to the top of the search algorithm, and then other times they felt like that was being overly hacked. But I think that's the positive reason why platforms hide this information. The negative reason is they want to keep the valuations high and it doesn't look good enough yet.
It's definitely a very important thing about platforms. I mean, you mentioned Google, and we have a whole industry around that called search engine optimization. Lots of companies just specialize trying to figure out what's the algorithm doing right now or currently, current version.
Yeah, and the degree to which the platform becomes large, like the prize for that just creates a cottage industry of how do you you know, how do you best perform in platform, which I think we see already starting to emerge in some of the logistics platforms already. I mean, there's certainly advisors right now, right, that you could find who have made a cottage industry of how to get through RFQ platforms, how to maximize your business. Like if you're starting a carrier, like an asset operating carrier in the U.S., you certainly could find advisors that would help you best navigate the platforms like DAT, you know, Truckstop, and also the sort of semi-private platform, or the private platforms run by people like J.B. Hunt and C.H. Robinson and Navisphere and all that.
And their sales pitches, I imagine, same that they help sell their services and they specialize on these tools that are out there, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, again, going to kind of how do we assess platforms differently from normal businesses, one of the things that I certainly look for is the when we talk about the interaction, kind of the nature of that interaction, I'm looking for, well, how many factors need to go into making that interaction successful? So one of the things that I was always skeptical about for platforms that were essentially a play off of the arrival of Uber. So for a long time, people talk about, oh, we're launching an Uber for trucks, and then Uber for trucks arrived as Uber Freight, launched by Uber. And then they kind of backed off of that. Oh, at least in Europe, they just decided it isn't worth it. And then in the US, I mean, the financial results are pretty terrible. One of the things that was always interesting was the lack of attention to how much more heterogeneous the factors of a good match are in logistics. So, right, if I'm looking for a ride on Uber as Jonah to get to the airport, I got waiting time to my pickup, I got desirability of the destination point, and I've got the number of passengers, and that's it, right? So it's like three factors to get to a match. I don't care what color the, you know, the ride is. I don't care what model the car is, all that stuff doesn't matter. Logistics, you know, trucking, so many more match factors are involved here. And what this tells me, when I hear about a platform in our industry in logistics, I'm immediately checking on this topic in my mind. So what I'm first thing I'm thinking is, if it's a high heterogeneity of match factors, so if you need to match in like 30 or 40 things, you got to have big time scale to get off the ground. That doesn't work unless you somehow can get the cold start problem is harder, right? The cold start problem being a reference to like what do you do on day one in these sort of environments. Well, you got a lot more people on there because there's a lot more ways to not be a good match. The second thing that comes to mind is with these high heterogeneity of match factors is that if you can get off the ground, if you can be creating matches, they're probably more durable. Like this is probably a harder platform to dislodge because the chances of just kind of raw chance to make such a match is going to be hot, is going to be lower. So it's harder to compete with as a result. And the third thing I check for, this is my like checking for vaporware, is does the platform who says they're going to provide that interaction, that match, do they even have a way to give this data? So I'll give an example. There's a company called LoadFox, no longer around, but they used to, their tagline was they were doing playing Tetris with part loads. And they you know, said that they're doing matching between shippers and logistics providers in a way that they would sort of do the 3D optimization of putting things into a truck. And that's an example where there's a lot of heterogeneity. You really need to know a lot of things to be able to co-load cargo. But then if you checked their API and what data you could send them about your shipment, it didn't include any of that stuff. So if I can't tell you that my cargo is temperature controlled, then you probably can't match me based on temperature control. And so it's just sort of like, that's my vaporware check on platforms is, well, if a match requires 40 factors and you don't give me a way to tell you what those 40 factors are, then it's not, you're not going to be able to facilitate a match.
All the things that you or we're talking about right now seem to indicate to me that in order to really evaluate the platform business, you got to get your hands dirty.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to really understand how it works, who's on it, and can they get any value out of it?
Is it, you're totally right, Martin. And doesn't this feel like the definitive factor in logistics and logistics startups, that people who are incumbents in logistics have been in it for a while, this is what they would say when they see a new startup arriving who sort of seems to be saying that message of, you know, logistics has been done this way since the 90s, it's all Excel and email, and we're going to change the world. And the incumbents are like, yeah, details matter here, boys. Like, you really gotta, right? you gotta pay more attention. And then also those newbies, the people who are coming in from the outside who are saying that, they tend to sort of sheepishly say a little bit later, they're like, wow, the details really matter in this industry. I didn't realize there were that many details. And that seems to be the, I'm not going to call it a moat because that's sort of a loaded word, but that seems to be the barrier for the software eats world phenomenon hitting logistics, is a lot of that stuff dies at the edges because you got to operate at a very low level of detail in the business to have any chance of success.
Yeah.
Is that disheartening?
Yeah. No, I mean, I was just thinking that if I were to forecast the future of these tech startups that have come to logistics.
Please do.
So I would say that I think a fair share of them are considering specialization.
Yeah.
To some specific niche.
Yeah.
That has worked for them.
Yeah. Now, do you think that's because, do you think that's a defensive reaction? Like when they started out, they thought they did that kind of naive thing where they were like, they said, well, it's a huge addressable market. Mm-hmm. You know, we're gonna make the next Deca unicorn, and then when they hit reality, they said, well, wait, let's just specialize for now, and then we'll come back to the rest.
I think that given the wide net that they cast, they have to catch something probably, and then they're gonna narrow it down to that.
Okay, so it's opportunistic essentially. They cast a wide net. Something gels,
something and sticks. Then
they pursue that. Yeah,
I could imagine going that way.
Yeah, I could see that. And you know, just bring it back to the platform plays, because many of these are attempting to be platform plays. The things we're talking about, you know, the fact that you want to look for additive network effects. You want if you're going to be matching stuff up, you're probably going to face high heterogeneity, and then just the sheer sort of scale of the number of participants. Because one of the things that also probably lends itself to platform businesses in our logistics industry that we didn't touch on is just how broken up market share is. I mean, if you look at trucking, which is trucking, half of logistics cost is trucking worldwide. And if you look at who is the leader by market, say in the U.S. and Europe, and how much market share they have, you know, it's 2 or 2.5% in Europe and 1 or 1.5% in the U.S. for the market leader. It's just an insane. It's the opposite of concentration, where it would tell you that there's probably not an economy of scale in that business. And also, it would tell you if you want to be a platform, well, the value of the platform would be that people aren't going to be able to disintermediate you because there's just a lot of people to connect.
Do you think the problem could also be that the definition of the markets is just too broad? We shouldn't be thinking about logistics market, but maybe, you know, Chicago refrigerated markets.
I think so as well. I see the point. The flip side to it, though, is that, and the reason why I think people sort of end up popping up a level again and saying, well, let's just talk about the trucking market, the FTL trucking market, is as soon as you make it, as soon as you go down a level into kind of a micro market where you say, well, I'm really talking about, I don't know, refrigerated trailer, full truckload in Germany, is the participants in that market spill over into a bunch of other, you know, markets. And every time you try to find a framing in which the participants is a fixed group, you sort of kind of cut off half of the picture. And then you have to like reframe again a little bit larger to include those people. And then you've cut off half of the, you know, the picture again. And I think it can be, it's very challenging. You can't win them all at the same time. But if you're a business who's trying to somehow platform play for the logistics sector, if you do often end up with this catch 22 where you go, well, it's not valuable to do, for example, it just go back to this refrigerated, you know, full truckload Germany. It's like, well, it's not valuable to the participants in refrigerated truckload Germany to come into this platform if all I do is refrigerated truckload Germany, mm-hmm. because they also do Poland and Belgium. And you go, okay, yep, got it. You know, they need, I hear my customer, you know, my customer's telling me, but I also have, you know, Belgium and Poland. So can you please add that? And then when you expand out to Belgium and Poland, you find that those markets, like the Belgium market's got a bunch of people from France. And you go, got it. Okay, so, you know, they need France. So you expand out to France and you end up again. I think that's one of the things that kills platform plays in our sector, is that the critical scale that is needed for the cold start phase where you get off the ground is pretty high. I mean, you compare it again to Uber as a quintessential consumer platform, they go city by city. Like I would, you know, if I'm Uber, if I make Berlin work, it's more like Airbnb, where it's like Airbnb, yeah, as an example, has to kind of have everywhere for it to work.
Yeah, with Uber, I think they started even district by district.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
was exactly. Scale.
And hyper local.
With logistics, it's the borders are really not as well defined, because you have to cater to companies that work, let's say, on Germany-Poland lane, but the other parts or their customers in Poland perhaps work in Poland-Baltics yep. lane.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, it's hard to find something. Now, I think the clever startups, those who've sort of read 0 to 1 and understood you got to find a place where you can be the monopoly and whatever, You do look for something like that. Like you say, well, let's just focus on the companies that do the channel crossing, you know, from England to France, for example. And suddenly you're down to a group of people who is perhaps limited in scale enough and concentrated in scale enough. And I believe that as somebody who's launching a platform, this is kind of referred to as like nail the hard side first. You got to find the side that is going to be the one that can dictate the easy side to come to it. So mm-hmm. if you're an importer to the UK, because they have more imports than exports, but if you're an importer to the UK and tomorrow there was a platform where, say, half of the logistics companies that manage imports are directing you, like, hey, could you just go to this, like, I don't know, Rebrexit, Rebrexit platform, that the new the cool kids are using for their imports to the UK. Well, if like half of them say go there, that's the hard side. So you know, the importers will go there. I think there are some ways that platforms get off the ground in logistics like this. If I think about Zenata again, they did it with and some other companies like them did it by trying to find really big lighthouse names who would share rates, and FreightWaves did a bit of this as well, but it's still a challenge. I think it's not as easy, and this comes back to kind of outsiders think it's going to be easier in logistics than it is. It's hard. The details matter. There's a lot of heterogeneity, a lot of dimensions to deal with. One of the other things I want to throw out about that I look for in platforms for from the outside, is their value creation, their sort of network effect, is it same side or cross side? So the quintessential cross side one is I mentioned earlier with procurement would be, you know, a buyer comes in and now that there's a new buyer, it's sort of better for all the sellers because mm-hmm. the sellers have somebody they can generate revenue from, this new buyer, and the buyer has this large pool of sellers that they can get into, but it's not necessarily better for the other buyers. Or same thing, if a seller comes in, new trucking company joins this procurement platform, is that good for the other trucking companies? Well, you know, probably not, right? They're probably going to drive the prices a little bit lower, and they're going to take away some of the revenue, some of the volume from the existing players. Now, the same-sided kind of network effects would be something like Facebook, which is probably the quintessential one, which is when people like you and me, sort of not the advertisers, but the I don't even know what they call Facebook members, maybe users,
data providers.
Very, very, very clean, market-friendly word. I like it. It's not technical. It's something that, you know, your grandparents would say. So the data providers, data donors.
That's
when
better.
The data donors come into Facebook, the value accumulates. Obviously, there's value on the advertiser side, but it's also valuable for like me and you, right? So that same-sided value versus cross-site value seems to be a real determinant, perhaps in the kind of peak value potential of a platform. Because I have the feeling that when it's cross-side, what my feeling is that it's stickier, perhaps, but it's also it's more likely to be this replacive or kind of competitive network effect rather than the additive one, whereas same side seems to be more additive. Like there's just going to be more of us, and therefore we're going to get a better outcome.
Yeah, I think it's for a platform, it creates a small dilemma. So a platform is successful if the user base is dynamic, if it's not stale. If they constantly need to have more interactions in order to discover counterparties, when the network becomes stale, there's less need for the platform. I think that's one of the arguments that I would make. And on the other side, they would have to balance that an additional user on the platform, which is a competitor for the other same type of users, that this wouldn't kill off the platform. Because I think essentially what it's the danger is that somebody's going to start a competing platform, I think.
Yeah.
And they're going to win over those dissatisfied customers that aren't able to make deals on the platform.
This is actually...
Kind of like a saturation point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a question. Exactly. It's like a question of what is the saturation point of this platform? When you look at any platform business as it's structured on that day, I mean, obviously the operators of that platform business can tweak, what's the core value offering and kind of add additions and do things. But at any given moment, a platform's going to have some saturation point where you go, well, it will be valuable for most people to kind of opt into this until this point. But above that point, it's not less valuable, but it's not more valuable either. And I was thinking of this in the procurement example of a lot of the logistics companies. A retailer is not going to have very many logistics providers in a region. They may have, you know, if you're a big player, you may have 60 or something. So I may have six, if I'm a Carrefour, I may have 60 logistics providers doing full truckload between my distribution centers. So if I enter I'm looking for 60 completely new logistics providers. So no incumbent can stay with me next year, which would be a little weird, but let's say that incumbents are all out, you know, they broke my heart and I don't want to receive them again. So I wanted to pick 60 new logistics providers, and I joined this amazing procurement platform that has 60,000, you know, logistics providers in my region. You go, okay, great. So from the point of view of the logistics providers, you get a 0.1% chance of being chosen, all else being equal. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is like, well, if it was double the number of logistics providers, so it says 60,000, 120,000, and you're still picking 60, you go, is that meaningfully different? And I'm not sure on either side if that's really meaningfully different, if I'm honest, because the probability that you have some breakthrough on maybe a breakthrough on one of those providers or something, but you're not gonna, I doubt that. Well, another way to say it is, if you pick 60 and then I revealed behind door number two another 60,000 carriers that you could inspect, I don't think you would just throw out the first 60 and pick 60 from the new group. I think what you'd find is perhaps maybe half change or less. And therefore this indicates diminishing returns. If out of the first 60,000 you get 60 and then out of the next 60,000 you get 30, you've got some diminishing returns, and that indicates that there's a saturation point for the platform value. Mm-hmm. And this leads into the next thing, which is for you and me as kind of platform builders, probably the most interesting is the competitive dynamics. And you mentioned it a second ago, but just for people who are listening who didn't catch it, you know, platforms compete with their own members, because if the platform is facilitating interactions, and if we go back to like what's the platform doing, right? It's providing standards, it's facilitating interactions, and it's providing some sort of a resource reusage. But if the standards would otherwise be adhered to, and if the parties who are going to have the interaction already know each other, because as you said, it's quite a stable relationship, there will be people who say, let's just take this off the platform, right? Like, in other words, as a platform, you're an intermediary, and you have to compete with your members in order to not be disintermediated. Forwarders who are listening, who earlier heard us say that forwarders might be platforms, are going, yeah, totally. You gotta not be disintermediated.
Yeah. I think a lot of platforms have had that issue. And I don't know if there's a catch-all response to that. Mm-hmm. I think, for example, what Booking.com did was the requirement for hotels was that they have to use the infrastructure of Booking.com for payments and those sort of things. Mm-hmm. For others, I think they win with convenience. So Airbnb is just so easy to use.
Yeah.
Even if the host gives you a 10% discount, you know, you might take it, you might not. It's definitely easier to trust the platform than some unknown other provider or merchant who we are interacting with.
Yeah, are there other... Cause I think it's interesting, if we think about the competitive dynamics, which is kind of where we're at now, is like competition, or another way to say this is value capture. So if I'm a platform operator, if I built a logistics platform and people are using it, they're finding it valuable, how much can my take rate be, right? How much can I charge people and extract out of that interaction? And the first dimension that they compete with is that the people just go off the platform. They go, yeah, it's great. You know, I really enjoyed using Jonah's platform to find my new customs clearance agent. But now that I've found the customs clearance agent, I really like her. And so we're going to go do a direct contract. And so the things that, you know, I see as mechanisms that I'm kind of watching platforms for, it, one is legal. You mentioned it. I mean, Booking had this for a long time. I'm not sure if this is held up in court everywhere, but they used to have agreements with hotels that said you can't offer a lower price outside of Booking.com. So you have to offer your lowest price through us. And that certainly makes it less advantageous to go around their platform. Then it's the convenience factor. I think that, especially in B2B, actually drives, it's called inertia once you're on. You know, inertia in business typically is the determining factor of how people will behave. They'll simply behave the way that they did in the past. And then there is some sort of risk element to this. Like, I know with Airbnb, they have this thing where they'll insure, you know, they'll provide you a level of insurance if you're the homeowner who's renting, if you're the host, they would say, if you're renting out your home and you just took some cash from somebody because you went off the platform and then they steal a bunch of stuff. Well, like, yeah, you file a criminal complaint, but you know, it's sort of on you to pay for your stuff. But if you did it through Airbnb and let them take their fees, well, if there's that sort of an incident, they'll cover insurance. Are there others besides though? Like just thinking of, so we talked about risk, we talked about contractual terms, and we talked about convenience.
Monetization comes to mind.
Yeah.
So if you know the cycle, how long does it take for somebody to want to interact again? Then you could create a monetization strategy catered to that cycle.
So incentivize the early interactions, or sort of change when the value is delivered for them so that they stay on the platform at crucial times.
I guess the idea there is that if it's a fixed subscription cost or fee, then it has to cover multiple transactions. So if you're already paid for that, for the transaction, what's the point of going offline?
Right. Yeah. So playing with the monetization, playing with the pricing dynamic so that you make the buy decision at a moment when you need the platform. And then when you might go off the platform, it would give you no financial upside to do so. That's clever. That's really cool. That's an interesting idea. Yeah. I think the natural one that we sort of skipped over, but is probably what platforms would hope they're using to keep their members on them, is just optimal outcomes. Some version of, yeah, you can go off of us, but you'll just be back to where you were prior to using us, which is you weren't quite sure if you were getting the best outcome, or you know you were wondering what other possible interactions would be of more value, and you won't know. So it's a sort of you have no assurance of optimal outcome if you go off of us.
Is it kind of like trying to read last week's newspaper over and over again?
I think it'd be like reading last week's newspaper, or it would be like, back to my stock buying example. We see this in logistics, so let's just use logistics. We need to go outside the industry. You know, if I did a sourcing event and I use somebody's platform to benchmark rates and to check service levels and validate that the people who are making me offers have like the correct insurance levels and everything. So I use the platform for its superior kind of data capture and awareness. And then the next year, instead of using the platform, we decide, well, we're just gonna do this bilaterally. You know, we're just gonna negotiate together. What you miss is, well, what information you know about your counterparty. So that's the platform's no longer gonna provide you data there. But it's the people you don't know about that the platform would provide you data. So the counterparty discovery and the price discovery about those people. And I suspect that most logistics platforms kind of place their chips on that bet, that's really what they're trying to achieve. And then maybe it doesn't work and they sort of dabble in these other elements.
Yeah, makes sense.
I wonder if there's also reputational elements, like
brands.
Like brand value. I'm thinking about someone like Gartner here, who acts as a platform for salespeople to meet with, budget holders at conferences, and both sides pay to get into that platform to have those interactions. But there's brand equity associated with being at or in the Gartner, you know, ecosystem or event, and so. Sure, you could go, let's say that you were a supply chain officer at a company, you could decide, no, I'm not going to spend the money to be on that platform or in those events. And I'm simply going to invite the same companies that were at that event to come talk come talk to my team here. What you'd be forgoing is not just the awareness or whatever, but you'd be forgoing some measure of like reputation and brand associated with the Gartner stamp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how strong that effect would be in logistics.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to put a finger on it.
We don't have a lot of strong brands, right?
I'm just not sure whether people would pay extra for the brand.
Yeah. 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 Or if they do, it's the leader margin on brand is not an enormous addition, right? For kind of leading brand platform, my impression is right now the platform plays that are happening in logistics are almost the opposite. Like they're subsidizing membership by often by discounting, you know, their services or otherwise sort of like delaying the fees to join the platform. And as a result, you almost have the opposite, right?
Yeah. I mean, from an outside perspective, one could assume that logistics traditionally having relatively low margins would not be very suitable for brands type of barriers.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. If we look at some other industries, so like I'll take mobile phones for example. There's the whole gamut with mobile phones. You've got incredible margins with brands associated with like iPhone. Apple. So the iPhone line is just incredible margins. And I think you'd have to squint pretty hard to see a, you know, hardware difference. There's hardware differences, but are they margin inducing? I'm not so sure. And there are obviously feature sort of, there's the whole feature lock in into the ecosystem, and I get that. That's also value creating, but that whole thing is wrapped up also in brand. So could someone do that in logistics?
Luxury logistics.
Yeah.
Trucking.
Well, I think one of the ironies with, one of the reasons why we keep, as an industry, we keep being circled by these sort of VC-backed startups that maybe don't really know the industry, is from the outside, it just sounds ridiculous that things that we take for granted as a consumer are not possible in supply chain. You know, why can't I track every package through every handling point that it goes through? Like, why can't I get next day delivery for just every category of goods in the same that region that I can get it from a leader like Amazon. So I think a company that would just do it, you know, that would just make excellent logistics and make that associated with their brand, maybe they could. I'm not sure. Maybe that's not a feasible thing to create a business. Like maybe that's not possible. I don't know, but that would be a direction I would think where a brand would be able to break through.
Maybe, all right. Yeah. Maybe with younger people entering the industry, maybe they might be more tech savvy, or maybe some tools might attract certain type of people and then they get attached to the brand.
Yeah.
That seems to have happened in the IT industry.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people prefer Slack to other messaging platforms. Hard to say whether it's because of the brand or because of the value that they get out of it.
Yeah, I think the brand valiance is essentially a trust that, so for an existing product, it's sort of clear, you can measure it an existing service, you can sort of measure it on what it is. But I think the brand power comes from a willingness to forego or preempt evaluation on what it is, on the basis that you'll simply trust that thing will be better. And given, if you know, to its credit, for brand power, if I think about logistics, a lot of the pricing power would come from agreements around, can I trust this provider. I know from being on the buying and the selling side in logistics services that there's a pretty decent room for premiums if you know that you won't be embarrassed or let down. Because most companies, I think about a company like Adidas, it's like, I don't know, 3% maybe of their revenue might go towards logistics. Like, if that goes up by 10%, but the number of disappointed customers goes down substantially, then no one will blink at that. So I think there's definitely sectors like pharma, high value goods, fast fashion brands, kind of high end brands, luxury. There's definitely segments where the logistics branding as a purveyor of kind of certainty and high quality would work. I mean, to bring it back to platform plays, I think that that's certainly a possible way to avoid being disintermediated with your buyer, your sort of your members.
Mm-hmm. I'm still on the fence, yeah. But it's because I have a hard time distinguishing between brand and value delivered.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I'm kind of intermingling them right now. Well, okay, so we talked about competition with your own members as a platform. What about the competition between platforms? Kind of what are we looking for when we're inspecting a platform for hallmarks of something that's really going to compete well against other platforms? One of the ones that I'll throw out there is that they got the standards right. I really think you mentioned that this is probably more than half of the game, I think, in building a platform in logistics is what you mentioned when we talked about standards was that so many people will resist standard setting because they feel like adhering to somebody else's kind of poorly defined standards eliminates their competitive advantage. And so I feel like the industry has been just cries out constantly for good standards, but at the same time rejects most of the standards that have been thrown out there, not because it doesn't want standards, but because they are simply not well thought through. And so when I look at platform to platform competition, is a logistics platform that's coming up, let's assume that it can keep its members on platform. How is it going to compete with another platform that tries to offer a similar service? It's that standard. And the standards isn't just like defining the data, but it's also like the process. What can you do mm-hmm. with the data? Simple things like you guys have agreed on it. Let's say you've agreed on a purchase. Can you negate that? Is that cancelable? And so some platform might say, no, it's immutable. It's once it's done, it's done. But some people might say it's double opt-in where, well, the buyer and the seller have to both agree to cancel it. Some would say, well, just the more powerful side will get to decide that. Maybe the buyer gets to cancel if they want to. And that's the kind of thing where the platform has to draw its own line in the sand and say, these are the standards we're going to set. Because if they say there's no standard, then we're back to, well, why would the members stay on platform? Like, what's the value add to them?
Yeah. I think each platform has to take a stance of how much value they're going to provide to one side versus another, how they're going to monetize. Platforms don't have to be symmetric in that sense. They can be highly asymmetric and still work quite well and work for all parties. So that's an interesting thing. And then, a risk that platforms have to take as part of their design, internal design.
And in your mind, when you're assessing the competitiveness of a logistics platform, so let's say that there was a logistics platform, let's say DAT in the US, where you've got load board, or in European terms, this would be like Timocom, where you have carriers and you have freight forwarders, and they're finding each other to kind of like Craigslist style, frankly. They're kind of finding each other to negotiate offline. So they find each other, and then they, through their help wanted ad, and then they kind of go offline to negotiate the price and strike an agreement. If we look at the monetization, like you just mentioned, you could have a symmetric monetization, which is I'm going to charge both sides roughly the same, you know, the same amount. Or you could have a highly asymmetrical one where it's like, I'm going to charge one side the entirety of the... You could even have go the further. I'm going to charge one side a lot of money, and I'm going to, in effect,
the other one.
Subsidize or pay the other one. In your assessment, is one model inherently more competitively strong than the other?
Well, with the asymmetric option going as far as subsidizing, I think it does create a explicit barrier. Mm. So it raises the switching costs.
Yes.
So your competitor could copy it. Well, I guess then you're out of luck. But there's still a significant switching cost for these people to leave the platform versus to another platform where they don't get subsidized, where they perhaps have to pay.
Yeah, there's essentially a counterpositioning element to this, which says that maybe the lead-in expectation of everybody in the world is I'll be charged for what I use, or I'll be charged for things that are valuable to me. And so when you arrive at something which is free, or even essentially pays you to use it, there is something that's sort of inherently motivating about that. And so if you think about the search space, was like Google search is incredibly valuable. I would pay at least single digit thousands, if not more, euros or US dollars per year to use Google search if it was paywalled that way. But it's not paywalled that way. And so I'm super sticky to Google, right? Like, it's free to me. They got to really screw it up before I would leave them. And they've created this barrier for their competitors that says, well, if you want to, you want to play this game, by the way, you can't charge one of the sides of this three or four sided platform. You'll have to, because the thing about their platform is kind of SEO searchers, advertisers, and then content, right? Content yeah. owners. So you got kind of four sides essentially, and they would go like, yeah, if you want to get in on this, you could, if you want to compete with us, we've set the terms such that you have to run this highly asymmetric commercial model. And I kind of agree with you that I think that my intuition is that asymmetric platform models are commercial models are inherently harder to overcome as the platform competition. Interestingly, I think that the downside to them is that the competition might start to evolve around the
other side.
And in particular, I could see two ways that competition evolves that's just sort of negative for everybody, which is one is the other side, is so the payer becomes the kind of overly focused on in platforms. So you sort of degrade the value create, because the value create, the more in a business, the more you make your value create go off of the track of the value capture, then the more conflict of interest you have, right? Like, if the platform just gets to capture exactly a percentage of every time it creates value, that would be best, because then there would be total alignment. But if it's this, the more asymmetric the commercial model, the more likely you are to have a platform, creators or managers of the platform that get off track and they focus too much on the payor at the detriment of like total value create. And the second is that I suspect that this would start to lead to competition, which is essentially discounting down. I'm thinking of things like the insurance industry, where like now if you run an insurance if you were to run an insurance business, the insurance premiums are actually lower than the expected payout amount. So you'll if you just were to collect the premiums and then pay out, you would lose money. You have to deploy the capital in an effective way. Or if you think about like CRM or Slack, right? Like, you think about Slack is super valuable, and these other messaging applications, Salesforce, super valuable, but the competition has forced them to, in effect, discount, because they say, well, the lifetime value is really high, so I'm going to discount to win business in the beginning. And that's brought the margins of those businesses down. And I suspect that something like that could get off the ground faster with an asymmetric, that kind of price war, could get off the ground faster with an asymmetric platform commercial model against an asymmetric model than with a symmetric one.
I'm just thinking about examples that come to mind about platforms that apply this asymmetric monetization. It seems to me that it's usually the buyers who get the better deal on these platforms. You mentioned Google. So in terms of ads, it's usually consumers like you and me who end mm-hmm. up buying those products.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about, let's say, restaurant table booking platforms. Yeah. You don't usually pay there. Sometimes you even get a discount after every 10th, you know, booking.
Yeah.
Do you have any counter examples or anything comes to mind where it's the seller?
It's where it's the seller that's the incentivized party, the party who gets sort of the best deal.
Like a shopping mall where the customers have to pay to get in.
Well, yeah, actually, one does come to mind in the case of Airbnb. So the hard side in Airbnb is what they would call the host, which is the housing owner. So, you know, if you look at Airbnb, they subsidize, or at least for a long time, maybe not now, but for a long time, they subsidized, catered to, they provided higher quality service to the sellers, the homeowners, what they would call the hosts. Because fundamentally, if you think about the demand side, the buyers, so I'm Joe's going on vacation, Jonah's going to stay someplace, that could be intercepted. That was like a flow of demand that could be intercepted. Every given day, every given hour, there's a certain number of people who are just looking for a place to stay, right? Like just flow of demand. And you can intercept that demand in straightforward kind of marketing ways. They turned out to not be very good at this. They have mostly organic volume, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Someone like Booking kind of gets it through Google AdWords, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the hosts, you know, you and me, if we want to rent out our house, like we are not just, there's not just a flow of these people. It's very idiosyncratic and it's a smaller group. And, you know, if they're gone, they're gone, right? Like they're not, they don't, it's going to be very hard to get them back. So yeah, I agree with you that in most of the world, there's kind of like buyers are the limited quantity and sellers are the ones who are popping up and then disappearing and popping up again. And, you know, they're the easy side of the market, but there are exceptions to that where the seller is the hard side of the market.
Yeah.
And the platforms, you know, the smart platform operators then play that.
Yeah. I guess logistics is also the case where it's not always clear which side is harder to win over.
Right.
Given how fragmented, diverse the space is.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy it, but we hear it all the time that there's a swing in the market, and now because you know, now it's the carrier's market, or it's the you know, it with the ocean shipping, it was like now it's the ocean shipping lines market because there's not enough capacity and there's all this demand, and so they're the ones with the pricing power. And in transportation, it feels like every submarket within transportation, there's this constant oscillation between who has the power, which makes it very challenging, I believe, for platform plays to come in, because you can't just focus on cornering the hard side of the market. What is the hard side keeps switching, with the exception of some niches where it's like parcel, for example. There's just a couple sellers in parcel that you know, you got kind of five or six companies that you would need to, if you wanted to start a platform for a parcel, there's only kind of five or six sellers that you would really want to nail, for example. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I look for also when I'm thinking about platform to platform competition is the true relate. So when I'm thinking about, when I see a logistics platform and I think, what would it take to unseat that logistics platform? I really try to inspect the interaction, which is at the core of the platform, so the kind of the matching event or the interaction. I try to inspect like how did that interaction come about, because I kind of classify it into four categories. So I'm going to use procurement both because I think about this area a lot, but I think it's a massive area for logistics platforms, So when a buyer and a seller find each other in something like a, let's say, a Freightos type company, so level one, which would be the simplest and easiest for another platform to replace, is navigation. There's essentially a catalog exposed. One or the other side knows who they're looking for inside that catalog, or they know some element they're looking for, so they look at like who does what service in the catalog. So this is like search, basically. But they navigate to the party they're looking for and engage in that interaction. And then the second level is a search where you maybe know the metadata, but you don't know the actual catalog. So this would be like, I can't see the entire member list of this platform, and I don't know them. So there's counterparty discovery going on. Like, I don't know these people, but I know the kind of company I want to look for. And so I use search to find that kind of company, and then we begin the interaction. I think the third, where it starts to get more interesting, is platform recommendations. And the platform recommendation differs because the member who's initiating the interaction, they may not actually, they definitely don't need to know the catalog of other members on the platform, but they also don't necessarily need to extrinsically have stated their desires. So the recommendation engine, the recommendation process, it's not just a search, right? It wasn't like, you tell me what you're looking for and I give you back results. It's other people who are like you would be looking for this, or other times when you came to us, you were looking for something like this, and then here's a potentially delightful interaction. And when that succeeds, platform definitely has more competitive power. And then the last, which is the kind of the deepest possibility here, is assignment. So it's like, and this you see with somebody, this is where the freight forwarders really are, where you go to, let's say Uber Freight, when I commit to a truck on Uber Freight, I don't have to navigate their list. I don't search for trucks. They don't recommend trucks to me. They just assign a truck to me. And as a result, another platform who's competing with them has either got to give assignment level matching kind of as their interaction style, or they got to provide a hell of a lot more value that would make me move down that ladder to like recommendations or search, because the higher up the ladder you go, the more like lifting essentially the platform does to facilitate that interaction. So just to recap, members achieving their interaction or their match through kind of four levels, like the navigation, meaning they know who the other members are, search, meaning they don't know who they are, but they can find them in ways that are straightforward based on what they want. Recommendations, which is they don't really know what they want, but the platform brings them great potentials. And then assignment, which means the platform takes full responsibility for picking and then kind of consummating the interaction or the match. To me, the further up you get up in this list, the higher the bar you set for another platform to dislodge you, that you're essentially saying that there's inherently more value in being added by the platform as an intermediary. Therefore, if you want to come intermediate instead of me, you better add that much value or more.
Yeah. You could have niche products around each of those four areas and still have a successful business.
Yes. Yeah. So you're saying you think that it's not sort of always one level up is better, that there's demand out there for essentially, like, to your point, I guess, there's demand for recommendations in a sense, in a situation where people wouldn't want an assignment. They want to still choose, even though that takes some effort and they may make a bad choice, that they want the agency that recommendation leaves them.
I guess I'm saying that all those use cases might be valid at some time or another, and you could build a product around it. I don't disagree that having a fully automated system is just much more harder to build, and thus it's easier to protect that business.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. That there's niches at every level. The last thing I had in my list for assessing platform to platform competition is a kind of a lock-in effect, where there's this term multi-homing, where someone could, so if we take visibility for a second, so someone could be using Forkites as well as, say, Project 44, as well as GT Nexus, as well as Transporeon, and there's this question of like, well, like why, what's to stop the members of these platforms from keeping homes kind of on each platform? And then from that perspective, so if you imagine a shipper, we'll use sort of generic terms here. If we imagine a shipper and a carrier, and the shipper says, yeah, we can get connectivity through Forkites or Transporeon, and the carrier says, oh, I'm on Forkites and Transporeon, kind of by definition, the platforms are then facing intense commoditization, where it's different if one of the sides is on both and the other one is only on one. But if they're both sides of that, the shipper and the carrier are sort of on both, then I think it's very challenging for the platforms to have a differentiated margin beyond just maybe economies of scale or how kind of the cost side of their equation.
Yeah, I think that's one of the perhaps downsides of maybe not even platforms or uniquely to platforms, but just digital businesses overall, that the margins tend to be perhaps lower profit margins, because it's easier to replicate a business, set up a new business. And maybe one of the things to look out for in terms of platforms is what's the upfront cost of building that platform. If it's significantly higher, it means that perhaps the market can sustain only so few businesses, and that might lead to more profitable businesses as well.
Yeah, now can we come back to the natural monopoly question of some platforms certainly seem like they will find their niche as natural monopolies. I believe load boards came close to this in the US and Europe. They didn't quite hit it, but you can imagine a world where, say, Timocom and DAT simply took the natural monopolies of those. Now, what in practice seems to have happened is that, to your point earlier, that logistics and or transportation in this case is not homogeneous enough to be called kind of one market. So, say in Europe, you had Timocom, who definitely had a chance to fill the natural monopoly first, but they didn't get sufficient cover. They weren't a VC-backed company who was going for complete scale, so they left niches uncovered where people like Telerute and Trans.eu in countries where Timocom wasn't fast enough sort of emerged, and therefore they didn't get complete domination. But I again go back to the multi-homing. I mean, on load boards, and as a great example, I have a hard time seeing the differential margin potential of let's say Trans.eu versus Timocom, just give an example, because all of the forwarders will be on every forwarder who operates, say, in Germany and Poland will have a Trans.eu account, and they'll have a Timocom account, and all of the carriers who operate there will have a Trans.eu account and a Timocom account. And I think specifically what it means is that neither one of those platforms can really move their, they have no pricing power. They can't unilaterally move their price up 20% without facing a migration of customers over to the other platform. And therefore their competitive basis really is just on the cost side of the equation. Like, can I cut out, well, sorry, their margin potential is really on the cost side of the equation. Rather than on the price point side of the equation.
Yeah, or providing some additional value, or starting up a new business line or something like that, expanding somewhere else.
Yeah, potentially, like, essentially not in this line of business, but some other line of business which is being funded somehow by the, you know, by the same company. But if you look at the line of business of the load boards, or what I think is called freight exchanges in Europe, totally commoditized. And I think when I think about the platform to platform competition aspect, when someone's mentioning a logistics platform and I'm trying to assess them in my mind, one of the elements is well, how effective would the members of this platform be at multi-homing? You know, can they go find other logistics platforms and sign up for them and use them? Or is there some sticky lock-in barrier that's going to make it? And I think you think about the sticky lock-in barriers, things like, I'm super reliant on the recommendation of this platform. Well, signing up for another platform is not going to, you can't take over your recommendations, right? The algorithms for those recommendations aren't yours to take with you. So that would be a good defensive maneuver for multi-homing. I think the thing that's the much weaker one is simply scale, simply just saying like, well, but we have more of X than this other platform. It's like, well, getting to X or getting more of X may not actually be as challenging as it looks at first sight.
Yeah, this sort of brings back the forecast that I tried to make. So another option could still be specializing on some specific aspect and providing differentiated experiences that way.
Yes.
So instead of scaling up, you scale down, you narrow down on something very specific.
Yeah. I think this reminds me a bit of the Delta model in strategy, which would say like, what really matters in strategy is your relationship with your customer. And the sort of narrowing down would say, no, what we're really going to do is we're really going to become more, essentially we're going to move to be more intimate with the customer. So it's not that we're going to try to have many, many more customers. It's that we're going to have a deeper, stickier, like deeper relationship with the customers we already have in a way that they would forego a kind of a broad platform because ours is so much better suited and that might be optimized to a process or it might be optimized to them as a business. I think, I'll give you an example that comes to mind immediately is Alimica, which is this, it's a chemical logistics sort of order management platform. And that thing I just said there where I said it's a chemical, it's like that's their defensibility as a platform is they're trying to say, well, we never really got any traction outside of chemical, but in chemical, people know us. And that's, as a platform, that's been their play. Maybe I would suspect that was defensive, that they just didn't get outside of the borders of chemical fast enough. And now they really haven't got a strength to do so. But maybe, as you said, maybe that was actually proactive and they wanted to stay on chemical and go deeper.
I guess the hope there is that the world is wide enough so other potential competitors might just find their own niche and wouldn't get to their turf.
Yeah, blue ocean, not red ocean stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's for the logistics, is it right? It's hard to find great statistics on this, but logistics seems to represent 4% of all spending on anything, anywhere. And so one would hope that with 4%, you know, 4 euros out of every 100 euros that are spent on anything is on logistics, one would expect there's a ton of space there for platforms to coexist. So one would hope that they focus on like making the pie bigger through creating value for all these different dimensions rather than checking out the pie that somebody else is making and trying to make a competitive version that they get a little bit more of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe we move on. So as we wrap it up here, there's kind of two questions that we said we wanted to look at. One was, what are notable platform businesses in our sector? And is there anything, you know, interesting to discuss about them? And then are there any underlying trends that are kind of shifting in favor or away from platform as a business model? So on the notable platform businesses in our sector, obviously you and I work for a notable platform business in our sector. So we would be careful here not to sort of talk our game and also not to talk our competitors' game. But I put kind of three categories together in my mind of platform businesses for logistics. So the first is anything that's about Internet of Things. And essentially there's physical things moving around the world and we're slowly instrumenting and addressing each of them uniquely. So slowly the number of uniquely addressable material things in the world is raising and the instrumentation of their qualities like their temperature, whether they are being shocked, how fast they're moving, and what orientation they're sitting, all of that stuff is coming up. And I think that there's tons of platform potential in this space, just huge flow of data. It wants to be shared, it wants to be standardized, and it can be linked to kind of clear value creation across multiple parties. Mm-hmm. The second was business objects messaging. So this is anything related to forecast, demand, supply, quotations, contracting, bill of material specification, invoices, proof of lading, transport orders, anything that's a business object that needs to be exchanged between parties. And I think there's a lot of platforms. This is quite mature now. There's quite a lot of platforms that try to do this. And then the last is business directories, because it's such a fractional market of logistics. Strangely, just a catalog of who is in logistics and what do they do and how good are they? That would be, if there's a encyclopedia that was definitive for that, that would be a beautiful platform by itself, even if it didn't do anything else. Yep. Any others?
One that comes to mind is visibility platforms.
Mm-hmm.
I think essentially they are data exchange layers. What sort of interests me about visibility platforms is their evolution, how they started with a particular value offer, which is people get to see where their stuff is at any given time. And I sort of see, or I would predict, that this data will get used in other services as well. So it will perhaps fuel those matchmaking services in the procurement areas.
Yeah, surely.
I think that's an interesting, I don't know if a conscious decision in terms of business strategy, but it's just an interesting development of how that particular product has turned into a strategically important data source.
Yeah, visibility is interesting as a category. You know, we talk about supply chain visibility. It is a combination of the first few categories I mentioned in this marriage, or this sort of dual apex of physical, sort of uniquely addressable physical objects and their attributes, combined with how those physical objects map onto our business objects, which are things like orders, transport orders, invoices, contracts, etc. And if it's just business objects against business objects, you've got the kind of V2 visibility, which is all just status visibility. You know, did you accept my transport order? Did you approve my invoice? Did you confirm payment? And then the kind of V3 visibility is merging that with overlaying that with a physical reality that says, the shipment that we're talking about is not just a ID in this table or this view. It's like a Internet of Things tag sitting on this pallet, and I have this super tight connection to this physical device and to my business objects. And that to me is where the visibility platforms as a platform play really have a kind of a future in the world, is not just the exchanging of the business objects and the statuses, and not just the harmonization of the Internet of Things, but it's the merger of the two.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of this notion of come for the tool, stay for the network as well.
Yeah.
It's a way to start a platform business in logistics. First, you build a specific tool for visibility. It's not necessarily that you care about the network underneath it, although network is a resource that's fueling the product, but the real value comes from what you can do with that data afterwards if you are the platform business.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the platform businesses here tend to use the tool. There seems to be a time play here where tool has to do with immediate use cases. So if I was making, just sake of argument, if I was making a new, TiVo, the Internet of Things sensor company that makes these kind of interesting, very, you know, very cost effective, very lightweight sensors for keeping track of where things are and their temperatures and all that. The tool is often the way, you know, the use case for the tool would often be an immediate need to track the, like, I need to know where this is. And I mean, where, like physically on Earth, where is it and what temperature is it? And what temperature was it in the last, say, 8 hours? But to your point, sort of once you've got the tool business case, which is kind of what pays for getting you started, and as a operator of that business is what got you the sale, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Then there's this longer time horizon use case where it goes, well, you know, actually, now that I have that data, and that data might be business partner related, or it might be, you know, temperature and shock and movement of goods. It's like, well, what else could I do with that? And it turns out that there's just a ton of stuff you can do with it. We're probably just scratching the surface on the potential downstream, longer term use cases of data that tools like that can unlock.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be a playbook in development.
Yeah.
Because I see visibility offerings or products popping up in many, many places. Lots of different tools are offering that capability.
Yeah. Indeed. And we would, you and I would sort of assume that the ones that have a single, it's not single player mode, but they have like a near-term practical tool-like application, they've got more potential than the ones that kind of need to be they need to be high-scale platform before their use case kicks in.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be.
Yeah. I mean, one of the counter patterns that I look for are people whose platform is some version of, if everybody were to change the way they work, life would be better. And, you know, you see this with every once in a while, a platform will come up that'll be like, you see it in particular with the standard setting of platforms, but something will come up where it's like, there is no path to get there. And I think that's the key thing about the counter pattern is, to your point, like, come for the tool, stay for the network implies that there was a reason to come at all. It was the tool, right? The tool was what motivated you to start. And then once you're there, you're getting this second order effect of network. I think there's a lot of platforms that forget the first element, which is if your platform is predicated on people just like all people or some large portion of people changing the way they work, and you haven't given the first people a huge immediate reason to change, then you've got no on-ramp. You know, it's be similar to everybody in the world agreeing to change their electric plugs to the same model. It's like, yeah, if you could do it, that would be beneficial, but there's no on-ramp to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're Europe and you just tell everyone to use the same charger plug for mobile phones.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's always government intervention that's could also work in terms of CO2 reduction.
Yeah. Yeah.
I could see that working that way.
Yeah. Or at least emission reporting. Mm. I wouldn't put it past particularly the EU, but other governments as well. I wouldn't put it past them to in effect mandate some form of platform usage as regards to emissions and sort of sustainable business.
Yeah.
I could see that. Yeah. Okay. Then the last question we had for this epic undertaking and understanding platform plays in logistics was, are there any trends that would change the analysis that you and I just painstakingly went through? So is there anything that's like saying, yeah, today that's how you should think about it, but by the way, the future is going to be different in some predictable way, and therefore, you know, really platform plays are going to become way more important or perhaps less important or more risky or something? The only one that I have in mind, and I'll just kind of call it out there, is that I think platform plays today are probably getting kind of an overestimating what their potential margins can be based on the lack of real know-how in creating platforms. There's very few people who are experts in creating platforms out there, very few leaders and product leaders or business leaders who know how to put together a good platform business, but that knowledge will accumulate. And I suspect that the kind of the leader margin, the best platform compared to the next best, you know, platform or the next best business model is quite large today. And then over time, that there will be a natural competitive element that forces it down. But that's simply because I think you could say the same thing for any new innovation in business models, where there is a leader advantage, and then eventually the rest of the community figures out how to counter it and brings it back down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of hard to predict those things. Like yeah. Right now, I think it's hard to predict what could bring down Google. And I think it's just as hard as it was maybe 30 years ago to predict what would bring down your local newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, it has been around for 100 years. Essentially, it takes a new type of technology that just hasn't been invented yet.
Yeah. I think also, I mean, to kind of talk the bull case here of like why would we think that platforms are going to be a dominant business model in logistics? It's not just that we don't know the future, like as you're describing, but it's also that this natural monopolies question of there probably are some segments of logistics or supply chain businesses which, once you have an effective platform in place, they are like the newspaper in a small town, where while it might be possible to sort of launch something new and price war your way, you know, into leadership, there's just nobody who's really willing to do so. So I mean, it would almost I'm thinking of why do, frankly, really dusty kind of load boards, both in the U.S. and in Europe, why do they stick around? It's like, well, because they sit in a natural monopoly, where you could dislodge them, but the cost of doing that is not worth the win. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that, well, that's not to anybody except for them, that's not to anybody in the industry's benefit. But I suspect that there are kind of stable equilibrium points where a decent platform play, which got into place in the industry in some logistics area, could maybe not grow, but also just run high margins and hold its ground.
Mm-hmm. And it comes down to, would you say, the network effects that they've established? It's hard to dislodge them.
Yeah.
Without like significant value offer.
Yeah, I think it's the heterogeneity of the matching. Mm-hmm. So if you take the load boards for example, I mean, let's just take a concrete example of, if you wanted to start a new load board in Europe and you wanted to go head to head with, say, Timocom and Trans-EU and Telerute and these players, is it fresh technology that they have? Like, no. Is the user experience pretty kludgy? Yes. So what would be the problem? Well, the problem is this sort of cold start problem of, they sit in a place where they're, the community wants to have just, that's why it's a natural monopoly. It's like the community wants to have just one provider. The community inherently has high switching cost, not because the load boards impose it on them, but because the community itself imposes it on them. Like, they want to just have one place where they can go to list their empty truck or to list their load and begin a negotiation. And so how would you get them off of that? You would need to have a lot of people switch at the same time. Well, okay, that's not going to happen. So how would you get the first people switch? You'd have to subsidize them a bit, like, you know, Uber launching in a new city. They start by just paying out of pocket for the drivers. Mm-hmm. Even if the drivers have no rides, they subsidize them so that they're ready and waiting when the riders arrive. And you'd have to have that kind of like almost VC-backed blitzscaling style expenditures, where someone would say, I'm just gonna pay up to move a significant section of the industry over to my new load board. And then let's say that you did that and somehow you moved enough people that there was this massive waterfall and everybody switched over to you. what is that resulting business worth? And I'm not sure it's worth the upfront cost, essentially. It's definitely not worth the risk-adjusted upfront cost if you said, like, well, and also there's a 50% chance I got it wrong. Then you're really not worth it. But even if you knew you were going to get it right, I'm not so sure it's worth it. So that, I think, and also the economy of scale kicks in, because think about what the competitive response is. If the Timocom and TrendsIDU see that they really were at risk, they already have the scale. So, and it's highly leveraged across, you know, they have a small engineering base, they have a small customer support base, and they have a large number of customers. So they can lower their prices and make it even worse of a business to come into. So they can sort of initiate a price war and make it even more costly to try to take their business from them. Because afterwards, you'll have what? You'll have a fraction of an even smaller market now. Like, that's where I think the natural monopoly effect could kick in for logistics businesses, where mm-hmm. in the future we see some logistics topics like load boards are natural monopolies, and therefore platforms get their ring around it early enough or securely enough, and then it just doesn't have innovation and kind of stays that way for too long.
So that's one point for the bull case.
Yeah.
Platforms. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at the start of the podcast, you mentioned that data standardization is something that you see as key.
Yeah.
As another pool gaze, I would add that carbon emissions and CO2 reduction and government intervention could lead to some sort of standardization that is imposed on the industry, and that would give headway for either existing platforms or new platforms.
Yeah, you're totally right. I think when you're thinking about businesses, especially sort of founding new businesses or targeting where to play, market selection of businesses or what to invest in, one of the most attractive segments you can head towards is anything that is any new market which will be created essentially by government declaration. So if government says from 2035, every logistics activity has to report its, its emissions in a certain way to a certain entity. And maybe because most logistics operations are sort of multi-party, the parties have to sign off on it. So maybe mm-hmm. like just for the sake of this hypothetical experiment, imagine, let's say Sweden. Sweden says all emissions which somehow touch our domestic, businesses, that you have to report them in a certain way. And the parties who are, providing or buying the logistics service have to both sign off on the transaction. So there's some sort of multi-partiness to the obligation, for sure. That's, I mean, immediately you go, well, that's going to be a platform, right? Like that is not going to be a license and install software. That's not going to be a consultancy that does a little project on the side. The business model is going to be platform software.
Yeah.
So you're right. There's a bull case that government mandate will simply necessitate platforms.
I think that's very realistic to expect that.
Yeah, in Europe at least, for sure.
Yeah.
I wouldn't bet. I sort of this sort of interventionism by European governments is the religion of the continent. It's like the high art and the center of the center of worship for intervention in markets. And on top of the emissions, they may actually be leader in world in that sense, where it may be something where they create the intervention, demonstrate that it works, and then other countries follow a similar path. Maybe not the same path, but similar path.
I think the second pull case that I could make, and it's kind of connected to that, is just the advancement of technology. And you mentioned IoT before.
Yeah.
With new trucks, I think those IoT or sensors are going to be much more standardized.
Yes.
So data gathering is going to be much more standardized, which is probably going to translate into the success of platforms that interact with these sensors.
So it's interesting. I agree with you, but you could also say that's a bear case because of multi-homing. So to the degree that the data format it becomes standardized and the data access becomes kind of ubiquitous, then it calls into question, like, why would one platform have any differentiation from another platform in that regard? And here, this is where I sort of see, like, platforms will either go the way of other business models and it'll be like, yeah, early fast fashion retailers, people like Zara, they just had the field, right? Nobody was competing with them. And then eventually people adapted to this to form competitive models in that space. And I suspect that platform plays and logistics will have a similar thing for some segments. And then for other segments, they'll corner the resource or they'll establish the unbreakable economy of scale or something, or they'll capture a natural monopoly where everyone in the industry just wants there to be one party anyway. And so they'll give their business to whoever's there first and not question it again. And so I suspect there'll be a very big dichotomy actually between very high margin, very difficult to break platforms, and platform is just another way to say business. Right. Mm-hmm. Kind of two outcomes.
Perhaps that's also an opportunity for companies who have invested or are willing to invest into data science or those sort
to
of
get their
applications.
First.
To get there first and to make use of the data and to provide that value that is for the competition harder to replicate later on, because they might not have the data, they might not have the resources to provide that value from day one.
Yeah. And the thing that we didn't talk about, because it's so hard to tell where this is going to go, is the move towards tokenization of data. Where, because, you know, I said at the beginning that one of the things that I find interesting about platform plays that are digital companies, essentially, that are software companies, is that data is replicatable. You know, my status update can be shared with you without me losing it. Whereas, you know, traditional physical exchanges, they have to establish ownership of a physical thing because I can't use it if you use it, etc. Well, tokenization brings back this ownership principle into data, where you go, well, if it's tokenized, you know, really I can share it with you in a way that I lose it and you gain it. And it's just way early days to see where that takes platform businesses and logistics. But you could imagine, somehow you can imagine platforms where data isn't simply kind of lost to the platform on capture and share, but that it's still rate limited by who, you know, it's some ownership is still maintained in a way that makes it look much more like a physical thing than a digital thing.
There are certainly groups working towards that vision. I still have a hard time seeing or analyzing those sort of businesses or business plans.
This is another place where it feels like I sort of show my age, because I almost intuitively go, wait, you want to bring scarcity back? Like, my a lot of my professional career and my mind and kind of all my energy has been on things like eliminating the silos and making it possible for people to capture once, share often data, and not every single, you know, party have to reinvent their data capture and sense making and analytical capability, that it somehow will achieve economies of scale in this. And then you get this tokenization that's like, whoa, brakes on that. Let's reinvent some business models where data is scarce. There'll be use cases for it. I mean, I'm not throwing it out wholesale. It's just, I agree with you. I have a hard time envisioning them right now.
Mm-hmm. This leads me to a bear case, but maybe you have more.
No, I'm out.
Okay. So, and we also talked about it a little bit before, and the bear case that I would make is, for a lot of companies in logistics, data is their bread and butter. It's it's not a very abstract thing for them. It's their operations. It's where they drive, for what prices and for whom. And so going on a platform platform where their data is potentially also used by, well, not used directly, but indirectly, others might benefit from that.
Yeah.
That's perhaps a scary thought.
Yes. Well, it's scary enough that they block it, essentially, is what you're saying. The bear case is it may very well be that it would be good for the everyone else in the universe, but if it's not good for the person who can make the decision, then they block it. Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, it's kind of hard to imagine a platform that brings together all those different loads from all those different load boards.
Yeah.
And provides that undifferentiated experience for the end user.
Yeah. Well, I know in Europe and I know Europe and in the US, there were companies that were acting as metasearch or aggregators of load boards, and they just got blocked by the leading load boards, you know, DET and Timocom, as I understand it. I mean, I didn't see the communications, but simply blocked them and said, your business, you know, your business violates terms and conditions that we've recently published and all members have to adhere to, and you can't simply scrape our load board and put it into a meta search or a meta load board. So I, even at a platform level, to kind of go back to like this incentive alignment bear case that you're talking about, even at a platform level, kind of the baby platforms, the like sub platforms, are going to resist being platformized by something larger than them if it's adverse to their commercials, kind of commercial outcomes.
So I think there are economic reasons why companies want to protect their data.
Yeah.
On platforms and sometimes also by not joining platforms.
Yeah. Well, and I think this bear case connects to one that I mentioned, this sort of anti-pattern of if everybody would just change, the world would be better, is it's the time phase of benefits that's the problem there. Is you have to change first, everyone else has to change at the same time, and then you get benefits. And you're describing a bear case, which is similar in nature. It's like, yeah, it might be good for the world later. Even might even be good for me later. If it's like a prisoner dilemma almost. It's like, yeah, it might be good for my future self if I were to agree with you to join your platform. But if it's bad for my quarter or my year, and that's the one I have to live through right now, and that I'm for sure going to experience, then I'm not going to give you my data, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if there's, I'm sure you've heard of different numbers, but one number that gets thrown around is this, we have 20% of empty
miles. Yeah.
So, okay, it might be 10, it might be 30, who knows. Yeah. But one could look at that number and then think that, okay, so if we fix that problem, does it mean that we have then 20% less business? Does that mean that I'm going to do 20% less business?
Or
maybe, you know, I'm going to do 100% less business because somebody is better at optimizing.
Yeah.
Some bigger player.
Well, I think the thing we mentioned with platform, when you and I think about platforms and sort of the best platforms are going to be asymmetrically commercialized, that whatever this 20% or whatever it is of wasted, you know, empty movement of a truck that has made its appearance on every single startup pitch deck of anybody in this space ever, that figure to me just cries out for asymmetric commercialization. Like, so think about what that means is right now, shippers, essentially buyers of trucking services, are paying trucking companies to move 20% of their kilometers or their miles, if you're in the US, empty. Someone's paying for that. It's not, you know, they don't do that stuff for free. The government doesn't pay for it. It's not subsidized. It's, you know, it's paid movement, but it's paid movement of nothing in the truck. So to your point, if you were to cut that out, I think the very naive pitch decks and presentations, elevator pitches from these startups is that like everybody will benefit. I think that's actually a failure path for someone to launch a platform. The current cost benefit is asymmetric, and therefore the right platform play is also asymmetrically should be asymmetrically structured, where there's a bull case in my mind that says, oh yeah, you could, I don't know, you're not gonna eliminate all of it, but you could eliminate a bit of that, but don't expect the benefits to accrue to sort of everybody. The benefits gonna accrue to one party probably.
Preferably the one who you're targeting.
I think the benefits are gonna accrue to the one that's the hardest to get on the platform, the hard side. You know, you're gonna cold start by getting one side on, and in this case, I gotta believe it would be the logistics provider, and you'd go, yeah, we're gonna eliminate this, but your rates will stay the same. Mm-hmm. You know, so you'll make either the truck doesn't move, so your drivers get home earlier, and they're, you know, everyone's happier, you have less wear and tear on your vehicle, or you get to go more do other jobs or something like that. And the right way to read that platform would be, and the shipper keeps paying the same price and nobody knows, right? And maybe the triangle here actually would be around emissions. Like the shipper would say, yeah, I'll keep paying the same price. I know that I'm, in theory, I could pay less, but you know, somehow I'm locked into the same pricing, but I get to get credit for the emission reduction. And then the carrier is like, I'm not giving up anything on money. My revenue is the same. So I get the revenue side, and the platform gets some sort of a cut of something. Okay. I think our epic exploration of platform plays in logistics is wrapping up. What's a takeaway after this prolonged conversation where we get to brainstorm on the topic? What's something that you like?
So I think the central theme was for a lot of the discussion was that size isn't everything. It's what's underneath the size that matters, that effects are interdependent. So what happens to one side affects the other side, and platforms have to take a stance on how they're going to cater to the different interests of the different sides on their platform. Can be symmetric, can be asymmetric. So I think these were the takeaways for me.
Yeah, I like them. I mean, I resonate with each of them. The one that hit me the most that I'm still processing in my mind is the extent to which kind of asymmetric commercial models probably are superior to symmetric commercial models, that for the counter positioning, as well as I suspect that a symmetric model might be shorthand for unoptimized. In other words, it might be that the group that launched the platform and is running the platform just hasn't yet thought through the actual, like the optimal way to commercialize the platform that they created. Mm-hmm. So, coming out of this discussion, I'm going to pay more attention to the symmetry of the commercial arrangements on the platform in our sector than I was before our conversation. I think that's a real important mm-hmm. takeaway for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what makes it interesting in logistics is that the market is dynamic. So
yeah,
what worked in one time might not work the year later, depending on how things go.
Well, yeah, you on the same topic, you had mentioned something that I hadn't thought of before, which is how to play essentially a rhythm game or rhythm strategy as regards to paying for the platform versus when you might want to kind of exit the platform with your and take your counterparties with you and transact off the platform. So if you gate it where like you have to pay for a year, you made a great point that if you gate it properly as a platform operator and someone has to pay to get in, once they're in the theme park or whatever, they're going to stay for the day. So it's sort of like if you just time it properly, the commercialization step and the ask and when they pay, that alone can help deal with the inherent competition you have with your members on the platform who have a incentive to disintermediate you and go directly to each other.
Mm.
Very, very interesting observation you had there, that the timing alone could be the the defensive factor to not being disintermediated as a platform. All right. It was interesting. Thanks very much. We'll do this again on some other topic that merits several hours of conversation.
Sure.
Thanks.
Later.
All right, that was the Logistics Tribe podcast deep dive on the topic of platforms in logistics. We are very interested in your feedback on this episode. Please visit Jonah's LinkedIn post that we link to in the show notes to contribute to the conversation and to let us know how you like this content. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.